How would you describe French rugby? There is a question. It is a bit of a cliche, but it remains a question that provokes debate. There are countless opinions, and for a long time those opinions changed like the weather. The French game has been characterised by its mercurial nature, brilliant but unpredictable. At times, the team has been impulsive, emotional, and eccentric, capable of extraordinary feats, yet sometimes underwhelming and unexceptional. They can be prodigious, inconsistent, stellar. But when they're at their best, French rugby is deserving of every superlative. Historically, such brilliance has not always been sustained. There have been periods when the team has failed to live up to its potential, leaving supporters yearning for better. Yet, if there's one thing that the French will not do, it is accept the status quo. Revolution runs in the veins. And rugby is no exception. When the system falters, change is inevitable. A surge in popularity, born out of a golden era of success, became a catalyst for comprehensive domestic reforms. These changes have fueled a renaissance in French rugby, transforming the national side from merely flamboyant entertainers to a truly dominant, formidable force. This is an episode about France in the Six Nations. And this is the Sporting Almanac podcast. Super Saturday. Incoming.
Super for everyone. Everyone's got something to win, something to lose, apart from England and Wales.
Whose positions are nailed on. And I guess, since we're talking France, the revolution has well and truly begun.
I think we probably also have to mention why we're talking about France now and not talking about England now, because we are due to be talking about England now.
We are.
Why are we not talking about England now?
Because we're going to do a post-mortem on England. We decided, why big this team up any more than it was prior to this tournament?
Yeah,
we can talk a little bit about England's past successes, but we're going to try and, well, you and I don't often do retrospective stuff, but on this occasion we're going to make an exception.
I think it kind of has to be done because it's been surprisingly bad result wise but also just performance wise and attitude and discipline especially. It's been extraordinary, really, so deserves its own episode, and let's do that après the France match.
Ah, nice.
That's about the extent of the French I know. Where we'll know exactly how bad the tournament's gone, and we are assuming going to be a defeat against France. But we are recording before.
We are recording before because we're going to get this French episode out on probably on the day, or if not slightly just the evening before. The Super Saturday crescendo to the tournament, which, you know, is a three-way fight between Ireland, Scotland and France.
Yeah.
French going for back-to-back titles and would have been going for the Grand Slam had it not been for an astonishing game of rugby.
Honestly,
at Murrayfield.
I've never seen anything like it.
90 points.
The scoreline alone was astonishing, but the attacking rugby on show was incredible.
Yeah, mad.
Why can't England play like that?
We'll come to that.
Caution to the wind, yeah.
I mean, like that. I mean, Scotland arguably have left the door far too ajar for France, because
yeah,
France scored four tries in the last 15 minutes to get a bonus point and nearly got a losing bonus point, nearly got a second bonus point, because if they had finished within seven, they would have got a second. But 50-40 it was, which leaves France top on points difference. By a bonus point, isn't it? France top by a bonus point. If they beat England with a bonus point, they cannot be caught. If they beat England and Scotland win but without a bonus point, that will also be enough. And if they beat England without a bonus point and Scotland get a bonus point, I think it's points difference.
Yeah, there is a world as well where if Scotland lose and France lose to England with two bonus points, as in scoring four tries and getting within 7 points as well for the second bonus point, Ireland could win, but France could win the title with less wins than Ireland have. They could win the title with three wins and two defeats.
Because of the bonus point.
Because of the bonus point, yeah.
Crazy.
Whereas Ireland would only have four wins, which would be insane and would almost certainly lead to rule changes the following year. But it's a situation which is already being covered off if there's a Grand Slam at stake. You get three bonus points for winning the Grand Slam, which means even if you don't get any bonus points and someone else racks up a ton of bonus points, then you can't be pipped to the title if you win the Grand Slam.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's covered off there, but, you know, it's bonus points. That works.
No, yeah, and that's happened to Italy once, albeit not with the same jeopardy. I think they came fifth with more wins than whoever came fourth.
Two wins and a draw, played two wins and
three losses.
Three defeats, but more bonus points, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But no, the French, I don't know. I like them. I like them, Jack. I
know you do.
I shouldn't admit it, but I shall. I like them a lot. They might be my second favourite team. If England don't win, I think I now turn to the French and hope that they win. And that's not because of rivalry. That's because I just think that they are awesome.
They are. And they are very good to watch. They play a brand of rugby, which is exciting. And they do it in a very, very clinical way. And it takes a lot to beat them. And Scotland showed that the other day by pulling off one of the greatest performances in their history.
Yeah.
Certainly. Certainly for the first 65 minutes of it.
Yeah. If you score 40 points away from home, you normally win, right? So it's got to be something special to do you. And, you know, maybe you could look at it the other way around and say the gap was significant and then they let the French back in. But irrespective of the order in which the points were scored, it was a pretty good showcase on how to play some ambitious attacking rugby.
Indeed.
But yeah, I mean, the thing about this French team, though, mate, for me, and I don't know if you agree with this, and there's obviously reasons for this and the reform of the French domestic game, but they have well and truly shed the label of being like, you know, these great entertainers that might upset the apple cart, that, you know, will probably pull off a famous win here or there in spectacular circumstances. I'm thinking 99 World Cup semi-final against New Zealand. I think they've done that a few times to them, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, big victories in the Six Nations, like flamboyant, a bit like Scotland, but more clinical, as in flatter to deceive occasionally, where you think they're going to go get slams but don't quite pull it off, but, you know, maybe with a bit more success in titles and stuff. They were very up and down.
Yeah.
But now I just think they are very up, up, up.
Yeah, I mean, you can sum it up by saying the last 3 5 Nations Championships, France won back-to-back Grand Slams and then got the wooden spoon to finish it. Which I think sums it up quite nicely.
Excellent.
What France were like. It was, you know, feast or famine, basically, a lot with them. Obviously a big generalization, but now they are just genuinely good. They are one of the best teams in world rugby, and it's built on a very, very solid foundation, which is going to be hard for the remaining Six Nations teams and even the rest of the world to bridge that gap to a certain extent because of the foundation they have with their league system.
I genuinely believe, and I know this is an easy thing to say, but out of all of the great rugby nations, I do think that these guys, if they get a World Cup, watch out.
Yeah, for sure. The fact they haven't yet is England are the only team from the Northern Hemisphere to have won the World Cup, which is fairly surprising at this juncture, although the World Cup's not that old, really, relatively speaking. What, 40 years old next year? So,
yeah, still. That's true, but they've made a final, 2011.
Yeah.
You know, have they made semis. They made the original final as well in 87.
I think, did they not reach the final in 1999 as well?
Yeah, against the Aussies.
They got battered by the Aussies. Well, fairly battered.
By World Cup standards, as in World Cup final standards, yeah. No, that's it. And like, I just think they just need to get that monkey off their back, really. They have an insane domestic setup. It's extremely popular in the southwest of France. Some major clubs down there, like Toulouse being the obvious one, but Toulon, La Rochelle.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Perpignan used to be very good. Pau. Yeah. Just heaps of them. I mean, you can keep listing them. And then you've got like Racing and people, Stade Francais in Paris. So like, it's a well-established sport now, and it's an actual factory of talent.
It is, yeah. A very interesting history, actually, of French rugby. I seem to mention rugby league a lot when I'm talking about rugby union, but the history of rugby league and rugby union next to each other in France is very, very interesting.
Yeah.
If you'd like to hear it.
Of course, yeah. Go ahead.
How did rugby get to France? Well, France were basically the first non-British or British Empire country to play rugby, and it was British expats who took it over there, which is a little bit akin to us giving Australia cricket, if you ask me. Paid the price for that a lot over the years.
Yeah.
It was first played in the north of the country, obviously a lot of British expats up near Le Havre and places like that. And then eventually made its way to Paris as well. Stade Francais, who we've already mentioned, they were founded in 1883. So very long and well-established sport in France. It was, as it is in Britain, it was very favoured by the country's elite originally. Most notably, a chap called Pierre de Coubertin, who was most famous for being the founding father of the modern Olympics. Yeah, he was a referee and an administrator in early French rugby. France actually won the first Olympic gold in rugby as well in 1900 in Paris, but they didn't play England for the first time until 1905, and then it was 1910 when they joined what was the Home Nations to rebrand it as the Five Nations from 1910. The interwar years, it had become a game enjoyed by all classes. It was popular all over France, and it made its way to the southwest of the country, Toulouse, Bordeaux, and the villages and towns in between, as we mentioned. It looked a bit like England did 30 years before in a few ways, in terms of the split between the elites in Paris and then the ordinary folk in the southwest of the country and in the villages particularly. After France were kicked out of the Five Nations in 1932, they were kicked out for professionalism or accusations of professionalism and a lot of dirty play as well. The journalist at Lotto, who we mentioned quite a lot, that's a newspaper that became L'Equipe, very famous sport newspaper, still going to this day. They tried to float the idea of France going the same way as Northern England had gone and to take up rugby league instead of playing rugby union. And this idea really did catch on in the 1930s. So Paris hosted an exhibition rugby league match between England and Australia in 1933. It was very well received by the press and spectators. A French rugby league team toured England the following year, so it got picked up really quickly. And with France having been banned from the Five Nations, suddenly this was the only opportunity. Like the French national team, any French national team had to play rugby, was rugby league now, because they weren't playing any international rugby union at this time. Yeah, it presented them with an opportunity to do the thing they loved to do the most, which was beat England at rugby. Basically, by the end of the 1930s, France was obsessed with rugby league. It looked like the tide had turned, and the number of league clubs now outnumbered the number of union clubs quite rapidly, and they were moving in the opposite direction as well. More and more league clubs were being founded, more and more union clubs were folding as they lost their players as a result. And it was also politically very popular with the left in the country. It was seen as the working man's sport, and the elites were seen as the ones who liked rugby union. And in 1936, France got a left-wing government, and they used rugby league as, you know, a platform to recruit, I guess, and to spread their word through. So rugby was now seen as an affront to the elite establishment, which obviously appealed to them. But what happened at the end of the 1930s, Ben? And into the 1940s?
Yeah, there was a minor skirmish going on the continent.
Bit of a disagreement, yeah. Germany won the Battle of France in 1940, occupied the country, split it into a fully occupied zone in the north of the country, and the south was ruled out of Vichy by a man named Marshal Philippe Pétain. That was Vichy France. Basically, they were a puppet state under Marshal Pétain, mm-hmm. who were loyal to the Nazis. As with most fascists at the time, the Vichys preferred amateur to professional sport, and as they were elite, they preferred rugby union to rugby league. So all sports basically had to go amateur or they faced being banned outright. But the exception to that was rugby league, which did not even get the choice to go amateur. It was just banned outright. All the rugby league clubs were folded and all their assets handed over to the French rugby union. And to this day, those assets have not been handed back. Rugby league was basically eliminated in the 4 years of Vichy France and the Nazi government in the north of the country.
Wow. And it's not really recovered from that, to be honest.
No, it never recovered, no.
Yeah.
And it was banned primarily due to its association with socialism, essentially, because it had become so popular in the years before the war. And yeah, all the clubs and players were forcibly absorbed back into rugby union. So the war ended. Marshal Pétain was imprisoned, died 5 years into his life sentence. France returned to the Five Nations as soon as it restarted in 1947. And as I said, to this very day, none of those assets seized by the rugby union have ever been given back to rugby league.
That's crazy.
They probably, I presume they never will at this point. It's been 80 years, so yeah, probably never will.
No one's lobbying for it either, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah, so there you go. I think that's a really interesting story.
That is a crazy story. I had not appreciated that it was so linked to the events of World War II.
Yeah.
It also makes a lot of sense in terms of, I mean, maybe this is a coincidence. I mean, I'm probably drawing pretty tenuous links here, but Vichy was the south of France,
yeah.
And that is where rugby union is at its most popular.
That's where rugby league was most popular initially as well.
Yeah, and Catalan are really the only, I mean, there are other French rugby league clubs now, but Catalan are the only ones that are sort of established.
Toulouse team, which again is the south.
Yeah, but they're competing with the Real Madrid of the domestic rugby game in Europe, Stade Toulouse, who are incredible and are only going to get stronger because they've just signed Menoncello or are about to sign Menoncello, the Italian 12, because they need more world-class talent in that side.
Well, you describe them as the Real Madrid, and well, you can never have too many Galacticos.
He is a Galactico, along with Blair Kinghorn, my favourite player. Another homage to him. So, yeah, mate, I genuinely, that was really informative. I didn't know that that was the background to how Union got so established in France. I think there's the other big sort of seismic event that happened in French rugby was in the 2010s in the lead up to the, sorry, well, 2010 to 2020. That period of time was very, very significant for French rugby because it is when they got serious.
Yeah.
And they, you know, taking it from, and we're generalizing enormously here, but taking it from the end of the war and the establishment of the amateur rugby union game, which was then played until 1995, as we've spoken about previously, they were that up and down French side. They were, you know, win some, lose some, win some, lose some. With the exception of maybe 86 to 89, where they did win four titles in a row, but only two outright. They shared two of those titles.
They famously won a Grand Slam as well in 1977, because that was the only one that broke that Welsh dominance at the end of the 70s.
That's right.
And was notable because there was a Welsh film made at the time called Grand Slam. And the premise of this film was some Welsh supporters going to France, going to Paris to watch the game in Paris and see them win the Grand Slam. But they had to change the ending of it because obviously France went and won that game. So the story became this, a story of glorious failure rather than a celebration of Welsh victory, which is interesting. I like that.
Yeah. I mean, they were up and down in the 80s. They won a few titles, shared a few titles, and like you say, the back end of the 80s. But that 70s title is really it's sort of like the feather in the cap because you'd have to go back. They won a few in the 60s, to be fair. This is what I mean about them. They were kind of up and down. They had moments in every decade, but were not the French that you and I know.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just think this is really interesting context. Maybe the best way of explaining it is rather than talking about the reform of French rugby in between 2010 and 2020 first, maybe we start at the Six Nations, the formation of the Six Nations, because everyone associates the early Six Nations years with English success.
Yeah.
And the back end of that like first decade as maybe like the emergence of Wales and obviously, as we've spoken about on another episode, you know, an Irish victory, a long overdue Irish victory. But let's get one thing crystal clear. There was only one team that dominated that first decade of Six Nations rugby, and it was the French.
Yeah, England were really, it was less about England's glorious successes and more about their near misses and glorious failures, if you want to call it that, which England love a glorious failure, but missing out on Grand Slams, missing out on titles, eventually getting the Grand Slam. But yeah, I mean, what, five titles in 9 years for the French? They were the dominant.
And three slams.
Yeah, and three slams. How is that not the dominant team? Basically, you talk about this glorious success of the Irish because it'd been so long and the Welsh becoming this heavily established team. But in the meantime, it was the French.
Yeah.
They were picking it. It certainly wasn't the Italians or the Scottish because they haven't won one. And England were missing out on titles left, right, and centre. Of course it was the French picking up the rest.
They really were. I mean, like 2002 was their first Six Nations title. England were back-to-back champs, rolling in like a juggernaut towards 2003. And so obviously, you know, in that context, let's be serious, that English team was incredible. So
it was
going to take something to stop them, right? Yeah. But England had come into the championship off the back of three blown Grand Slams in as many years, and France eased into the tournament with a pretty comfortable victory over Italy. Then they went to Wales in a ding-dong, to be fair, won that by just under a score, 4 points.
Nice.
And then came round three, which was the biggie, at home to England. France raced into a 17-0 lead. Jesus, yeah. Like, I think I sort of tried to erase some of these this period from the mind for the reasons that discussed previously.
I can't remember any, like, individual event that happens, but I can remember the feelings. I can remember the feelings of disappointment and it mattering so much.
Yeah.
Because we'll talk about this more in the England episode, and I don't want to keep going off topic and talking about England, but it was so palpable, like how close England had got to Grand Slams the past three seasons. And it's like 2002, still got this wonderful team. Surely this is our chance. And then France, well, carry on.
Yeah,
France go out and
17-0 up. Galtier, know him, the current coach, setting up tries in that game. Haron Ordicky, who...
Oh, legend.
That's like a streets will never forget rugby player. He was unbelievable, Haron Ordicky. Yeah, he scored on his debut. Yeah, I mean, look, they marched there on to 20 15 victory in the end. So England obviously threatening a comeback, bit of Jason Robinson magic, but Serge Betson, remember him?
Oh,
Chief Tormentor.
Also remember him. Do you know Serge Betson's nickname? This is one of the best nicknames ever.
No, go on.
It's the Four Shores, and I'm probably pronouncing that terribly, but it means the Reaper, which is excellent.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was a devastating flanker, and I just remember him targeting Wilkinson.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much exactly what he did. I think Clive Woodward is on record in that game as having said, he's only one player, but I can say that he's a single-handed reason that we lost that match. Words to that effect. But yeah. So, I mean, look, they've gone 3-3 here. Who else did they beat? They beat to Scotland quite comfortably, and then they come, you know, all comes together against Ireland in the final day, and they batter them 44-5.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And they were the first team ever to win a Six Nations Grand Slam, not England.
Yeah, yeah.
Despite England threatening so much. So, that hurt.
Yeah. It sucks, mate. But, like, yeah.
It made 2003 feel better because, spoiler alert, England did it, finally. But
2004, when England were world champions, guess who comes a-knocking again?
Bloody hell.
Did it again, the French. They went out in the semi-finals of the World Cup to England.
Yeah.
Death by 1,000 Johnny Wilkinson kick.
Not the prettiest game in the world.
Bad weather as well, I think. But yeah, they got off to a pretty good start again. They beat Ireland and Italy in Paris. They went to Wales, take on Cardiff in round three. That was a first half where Michalak and Vincent Clerc combined and put Haranordiki over again.
Nice.
Yeah, and then there was a bit of a wonder try from Jean-Baptiste Elessald. Again, pronunciation's questionable.
Yes.
But yeah, he scored a bit of a wonder try, I think, raced him from 60. Yeah, look, anyway, I think Michalak was on fire that day, 24 of France's 29 points or something like that. Or maybe it was, I don't know.
I remember him being very, as we've been talking about, in the mould of the old France, very feast or famine. He could be absolutely incredible on his day, and then he could be not on others. I may be giving him a disservice there a little bit, but that seems to be my memory of him.
Yeah, Michalak was very mercurial. He could do outrageous stuff, but he also had an error in him. I might have given him credit for all the points, and I think it was actually Alessandro that got them all, but doesn't really matter.
All right, okay. Doesn't matter.
France won 29-22, and yeah, they were much more convincing the following week with a 31-0 win over Scotland. And then at home to England in a very tightly fought, as you might imagine, given the status of those two sides at that time, 24-21 win and a second slam. But this, like, the reason we're setting this out is because it does lead into where we end up. Like, this French team whooped everyone for a decade and then fell off hard.
It was huge. It was a massive fall.
2006 was their next success. And we were just saying, like, the relevance of this period is the dominance to the drop-off, which leads us into where we currently are with France. But yeah, 2006 is interesting because, spoiler alert again, another French victory, but it was the last Six Nations that Ireland would be playing at Lansdowne Road before they moved to Croke Park for a bit whilst the Aviva was being constructed. They were obviously gunning for a big old send-off, thinking that they, you know, there might be a Lansdowne Road Six Nations title or something coming their way. France, on the other hand, had started with a away defeat in Scotland, so, you know, looking up for the Irish. So round two is going to prove pretty pivotal for the destination of the title. Sorry, that's awful.
I'll let you off.
But I yeah, so Ireland had come off the back of a pretty comfortable victory over Italy, and we're off to Paris to play them in round two. And the French were pretty determined to make amends for their first round defeat and handed out a 43-31 defeat to the Irish in a bit of a titanic tussle.
Yeah.
And from there, they didn't look back. They beat England, Italy and Wales, secured the title on points difference over Ireland, who had to settle for a consolation of the Triple Crown, a mere Triple Crown for the Irish on their last Lansdowne Road Six Nations. But yeah,
not good enough. Another one of those, I mean, we talked about this in the Ireland, one of their near misses that again led to 2009 becoming so sweet a finale.
Yeah, exactly. 2007 was that all-timer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
One of the great championships. Italy got their first away win of the tournament. They beat Scotland in Edinburgh. We've spoken about that on the Italy episode, so feel free to go back and listen to that if you're interested.
Yeah, can piece all these episodes together by this point, I think.
Yeah, yeah. First time that they'd won two of their matches as well. They went on to beat Wales in Rome. They finished fourth, their best result at the time and also since. But it's remembered because basically four teams had a mathematical chance of topping the table going into the final weekend. In the build-up to the competition, Ireland were being tipped as the favourites for the Grand Slam. They'd play very well during the autumn. However, having started strongly against Wales, they went and lost to France 2017 in a historic encounter at Croke Park. The first rugby game played at Croke Park, and France went into a 13-3 lead. Powerful bursts from Rafael Ibanez, that's a name.
Legend. Yeah.
Ireland responded with a try from O'Gara just before the half-hour mark. So it was 13-11 at the break. A couple of penalties from O'Gara gave them a lead with 3 minutes to go. But from the restart, the French recovered the ball, attacked down the right-hand side of the pitch. As the play came back towards the left, Vincent Clerc spotted a gap, danced his way over and snatched the victory for France. And Bauxez, Lionel Bauxez, I remember him because I remember his name not sounding the way it is written. Slotted.
I'm glad it was you pronouncing it because I'd forgotten that. I was staring at that thinking, good luck with this, Ben.
Yeah, anyway, he got the conversion, which sealed the deal, which is also very important. Ireland went on to beat England, who subsequently won against France. This all meant that the championship came down to a battle between Ireland and France. Mathematically, England was still in contention. By the time they kicked off, they needed a 57-point win in Cardiff, which was...
This wasn't this year's Wales team.
No, this was a rather good Wales team.
Yes.
An emerging Wales team is probably a better way of putting it, but certainly not one that was going to get 57-0 at home.
Well, one that was a year away from a Grand Slam, so pretty good.
Yes, very good. Yeah, and Ireland, they won 51-24 in Rome, needing a 24-point win over Scotland to claim the title. They were dealt an early blow, though. Nicky Walker climbed highest to claim Dan Park's cross-field kick for a try after just a couple of minutes, or 7 minutes, precisely. France responded with tries from Haron Ordeki and Yannick Jozion. Again.
What a player.
Yeah. Some serious names. Yeah. Anyway, Sean Lamont scored a quick tap and made it 20-14 at the break. So Ireland are looking pretty good here. And France are probably thinking, oh, it's another one of those, you know, cliched French slipaways. But after the break, they cut loose. They went mad. Cedric Haymans, David Marty, and Olivier Miloud all crossing in 10 second half minutes to put France 25 points up. 39-14, couple of kicks in there as well, obviously. You can do the math yourself. The Scotland battle back wasn't over. Ewan Murray's try 4 minutes from time, seemingly sending the trophy back to Ireland, only for Elvis Vermeulen to get over with the clock in the red for what would be the championship winning try. The referee referred the try to the TMO, an Irishman, asking him if there was any reason why the try should not be awarded. The TMO advised that there was no reason. The referee awarded the try. 46-19.
God, the temptation must have been real. It does need pointing out that unlike football matches, which the final games of most leagues and most league parts of tournaments are usually played all at the same time to avoid any sort of like collusion or, you know, we have to win by this much, let's find a result that works for both of us kind of thing, which has happened before. Doesn't happen in the Six Nations. The games are still staggered, so they knew exactly what they had to win by, and that Irish TMO knew exactly what they needed to win by for Ireland to take it. So fair play to him doing his job properly.
Very much so.
I would have been tempted otherwise.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it was a points difference win of 4 points.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah. So yeah, that kick in Ireland was important. That try in Scotland was important. Every, you know, like margins, mate.
This is, I kind of miss, I think you lose a bit of this with bonus points. You don't get this sort of points difference finishes like you got here, like you got famously, which was the one where three teams all had to outdo each other.
We talk about it all the time, 2015 or something like
something that. Something like that, yeah. But so you kind of lose that because obviously if France win by a bonus point at the weekend, then game over. Doesn't matter about points difference or anything else. So I don't know. That's what I kind of miss with the bonus points. I think bonus points on the whole is fairer, but yeah, miss this.
Yeah, I kind of miss it as well because it was bonus points are through the prism of like, oh, it rewards attacking rugby. And I guess that's true insofar as it rewards tries, but you know, looking back on some of these results and score lines, it's not indicative of a tournament that was ever conservative.
Like, no, exactly. So we talk about 46-19 result here because they had to win by 24 points.
Yeah, exactly.
They won by 27. It's great.
This is it. So yeah, another title for the French, and that would, you know, they were reaching the crest of their wave 2010 really was the sort of end of a golden era for French rugby. I mean, it's what we were going to say. It sparked a very barren run for them.
Yeah.
But before that happened, Marc Livremont was in charge and they swept all before them. Yeah. Pick of the games was probably against Ireland, who were then the reigning champions, having won the Grand Slam in 2009.
Yeah.
It was only round two. Everybody knew it would be pivotal. And Matteo Bastereau, remember him? Absolute juggernaut.
Beast. Yeah. How could you forget him?
Outside centre that looked like a front row.
Like no rugby player. I think he ended up playing number eight towards the end of his career, didn't he? Which seems like a more appropriate position. But, I mean, he was very effective.
Very effective. Cousin of William Gallas.
Oh, fair enough.
For those who like trivia. He had a storming game, caused havoc, dominated the midfield. Obviously, held off O'Driscoll as he set up Clement Potrano for the French's third try. And that's no mean feat because we've spoken about Bod. Yeah, anyway, look, they're... By the time that third try went over, the French were in control. Le Bleu, as they are affectionately known by their fans. And they scored, a couple more tries. Francois Trincondeur was in that team. I wanted to just say his name because I just remember his name. He was very good as well. They had so many wingers and stuff that just came and went. And like random tens that just came and went. But you just remember them for being unreal.
Yeah. Some of them did have short careers, but then you have some who... were sort of staples throughout this period. But yeah, around them, yeah, they did chop and change a lot. I felt like they chopped and changed a lot anyway.
Yeah. But yeah, look, 33-10 win for France against Ireland. They then went to Cardiff and beat a very good Welsh side before finishing it off with home wins against Italy and England to seal the slam in 2010. But it would be another 12 years before France had won another title in 2022.
It's doubly crazy when you think about it because, again, Scotland and Italy have never won the Six Nations. That means for that 12-year period, it was just three teams picking up all the titles. I mean, I'm throwing England the bone there by saying three teams picking up the titles. It was mainly
two, really.
Ireland and Wales,
yeah.
With England picking up a couple in the middle. But, yeah.
Yeah, England won in 11.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
16 and 17. And then Wales won 12-13 and Ireland won 14-15 and 18. Sorry, Wales won 19 as well, and England won 20. So, yeah, it was pretty evenly spread.
Okay. England won more than I thought.
Yeah, they did actually. But yeah, look, the thing that's interesting here is that this drop-off, they then hosted they were building up to the last World Cup, which they hosted in 2023. Is that right? Yeah, it is right.
Yes.
The next World Cup's coming up. Yeah. Just doing the math quickly. But look, they had a huge drop-off. They were very unsuccessful. But obviously, this sport was very popular now in France because they've just smashed everyone for a decade. And so there were questions being asked, big questions being asked about why this didn't translate into national success and what had happened. And the consequence of that is, you know, the French love a revolution. They love a protest. They do not mind kicking
it's
up.
True.
It's true.
Like, there's no point denying it. If things aren't going their way, they will not sit around and wait for it to change. They will make the change happen. It is part of their culture. For God's sake, they cut the heads of a whole load of people they didn't like 300 years ago. And that is culturally a very big thing for them.
The national anthem is about like
the
killing.
National anthem is so good.
Yeah, it's so good. It's very good. Les Marseillaises.
Yeah.
It's all about killing. Yeah, it's like revolution, basically. It's about killing people and soaking the fields of France in the blood of, like, traitors or something.
To armed citizens, form your battalions. Let's march. That their impure blood should water our fields.
Yeah. They're mad.
Put that up against God Save the King, for God's sake.
Yeah, look. So, the point is that they were really quite unhappy about the lack of success. And so, they really made sure they did something about it. And they reformed domestic French rugby with a view to effectively creating a talent factory for the national team in a build-up to the 2023 World Cup, which they really targeted. And, you know, like all things, it didn't happen overnight. Rome wasn't built in a day. There was that barren run of like, good 10 years. But the thing that's really interesting, I think, is that as of, where they come, 2018, 2019, they came fourth, right? And then from 2020, they've come second, first, and they will either come first or second this year, probably.
Probably first, yeah. It was it just turned out to be a disappointing World Cup, relatively speaking. I say disappointing World Cup.
Oh, they had a howler of a draw.
They got so unlucky. They beat New Zealand in their opening game.
Yeah.
And they won their group, a group which obviously contained New Zealand, which is
got South Africa.
No mean feat. And then got South Africa in the quarterfinals. How unfortunate do you get? South Africa obviously went on to win it because Ireland beat South Africa in their group stage. But if they hadn't, they'd have got Ireland, which is, I mean, not that much better, to be fair. There was very much an easy side and a hard side of that draw.
Yeah, there was.
Yeah, South Africa winning 3 knockout games in a row by a single point to win that World Cup, which is impressive, but could have been France. It really could have been France.
Whoever won that quarterfinal, I think, probably would have won that World Cup, and they were just horribly unlucky that the seeding system is taken a couple of years before the tournament, and so they ended up on a stinking side of the draw. But yeah, like they've reformed it again. They maybe don't have as sort of many eye catching titles yet, but if they win again this year, that will be 3 titles in since 2020 in 6 years, with every other finish being second, basically. So yeah, they are back, and they are led by Antoine Dupont, who is probably
possibly
the best player in the world.
Oh, arguably one of the best players to have ever lived. He's incredible.
Yes, he is incredible. And they also, this is how good they are. Damien Penaud is a try machine. He's like their top try scorer ever. He's got like, I don't know, near 50 tries and 55 caps or something. They've just decided to drop him because Louis Bierry is around now, who's a try machine. He's got like 26 and 26 or something like that. And Atsisobi, who they've now found on the other wing, and Tomo Ramos at fullback.
Ramos is so good. That assist, if you can call it that, in the Ireland game was incredible. The little kick, flung a left foot at it to knock it through, is just love it.
Yeah.
Hate it, but love it.
They're just a brilliant team. And that's France. That's what they did. They flat to deceive. They were inconsistent. They were winning. They were losing. They were winning. They were losing. The Six Nations come along. They fly out the traps. They hand it to everyone. And then all of a sudden, they just fall off. And the French rugby fan said, not on my watch. I want to see something change here. And change it did. And a 10-year cycle has led them straight back to the top of European rugby. Their club teams are dominant. They're incredible.
Yeah.
And the final, their Everest is a World Cup. Is a World Cup.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they're targeting. It's next year, a year and a half away now. They've got 1 Six Nations to win, this weekend. That's their only aim. That's what they'll be intending to do against England. Then they've got 1 more next year, which I'm sure they'll probably be intending on doing what they didn't do this year and getting a Grand Slam. And then on to the World Cup. I think they've got to be considered, well, maybe favourites.
Maybe favourites. They're certainly, I mean, they're better than New Zealand and Australia consistency-wise at the moment. South Africa
won
2 or 3 World Cups in a row now, though. So very difficult. That can't go on forever, though. So
it can't. And South Africa haven't, well, they did win the Rugby Championship this year, but it was patchy.
Yeah.
It was a patchy win. Mm-hmm. Like, it was all to play for going to the last couple of games, and they were just the team that came out on top, which obviously it's a difficult tournament. That's not to belittle the fact they won it, but they didn't dominate it.
They didn't dominate it. That's true. But yeah, that's France,
again, France haven't dominated the Six Nations because of Scotland. So
yeah,
I guess that's what happens.
It's what happens when it's very competitive. I mean, that's pretty much France. I mean, we haven't mentioned any of that. We've mentioned names as we've gone along, but can I just chuck a couple out there? Because this is the kind of talent they've always produced. Like Serge Blanco, Thierry Dusautoir.
Oh, player.
Yeah, serious player. Morgan Parra, Thomas Castagnier, Christopher Dominici. We've already said Ibanez. Maxime Medard, Philip Bernat-Salles, Emile Intervac, the father of Roman.
Yeah.
Aurien Rougerie. Remember how good he was? He was a funny old talent. Christopher Lamaison, Dimitri Yashvili.
kicking scrum half, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
Like, just talent after talent after talent. And now they've got Dupont. And they've also got 3 other scrum halves who would make it into every other nation's side who just don't get a look in because of him.
Well, of course not. Why would they?
Yeah, I know. But yeah, look, I find that as an Englishman, it irks me to admit it, but I really, really like the French.
I mean, objectively, if there wasn't the old rivalry there's no reason not to like them. They are doing things the right way. They're playing the game the right way. They have a factory of talent, as you say, and they have so much strength and depth. If any of these supers, as you say, like as good as DuPont is, if he got injured, they just pull up one of these other scrum halves and they're probably fine, even though they've lost the best player in the world. And the same goes for many other players that we mentioned. The depth they have is, it's incomparable compared to, I mean, England are the next best and they're nowhere near.
For depth, yeah, but not for
depth, yeah.
Not for
talent, no, let's not even pretend England are anywhere near them right now.
Well, yeah, we're going to talk about England next, and that's probably a really nice lead up and intro to that episode coming everyone's way soon enough, because there are parallels.
Yeah. In the meantime, we're also going to put out a mini episode where we're picking our Six Nations 15 as well. Yeah. Hopefully that'll be before the England episode. All time. Just the Six Nations, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Just making sure. Otherwise, I have to redo my list.
No. Six Nations, but all time Six Nations, not this season Six Nations.
Yes. Cool. Which will be fun.
It will be fun. Shall we leave it there?
Yeah. So we'll see how France do against England. Given our record so far in the Six Nations, probably going to lose to England now. We've said all that. And then Scotland are going to win the tournament.
Allez le bleu.
Yeah. And shall I just reinforce the fact that Scotland must be bloody kicking themselves they didn't beat Italy, because they'd be on for a Grand Slam if they did.
They have to support England if they beat Ireland, which is really funny. So
that is funny.
So I genuinely mean it from the bottom of my heart, Jack, when I say allez le bleu. I don't want to see Scotland win shit.
I will bite my tongue on that one. I think it's a bit of a win-win situation, shall we say.
Not for me. All right, mate. Shall we? I'll see you soon then, I guess.
I'll see you soon.
Bye, mate.
Bye. Thank you for joining us for our Six Nations series today. We hope you enjoyed what you heard. If you did and want to help out, a like, subscribe, comment or share would be amazing. But above all, tell a friend and spread the word. Thank you very much. Our theme tune is Oh Yeah by Harmony Productions. You can find us on Insta and Blue Sky at The Sporting Almanac. If you've got any ideas for future episodes or any good stories, drop us an email at sportingalmanacpodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you for the next episode. We hope you enjoy the Six Nations until then. And don't forget, sport is nothing without the history that makes it. Goodbye.